There were four men sitting in a semicircle around the wall of the hotel suite. They were all dressed in such fashion that it seemed a uniform. The dark, high-buttoned suits, the glazed celluloid collars and sober neckties. Although their ages was spread over 30 years, although one of them was bald with grey wisps around his ears and another had a fiery red bush of hair, although one wore a prim gold pince-nez pinched onto a thin aquiline nose, while another had the open, far-seeing gaze of the farmer, yet all of them had those solid, hewn, Calvinistic faces, indomitable, unrelenting, and strong as granite. Dirk Courtney spoke to them in the young language which had only recently received recognition as a separate entity from its parent Dutch, and had been given the name of Afrikaans. He spoke it with an elegance and precision that softened the reserve in their expressions and eased the set of jaw and the stiffness in their backs. "It's a jingo area," Dirk told them. "There is a Union Jack flying on every rooftop. It's a rich constituency, landowners, professional men. Your party has no appeal here." He was talking of the parliamentary constituency of Ladyburg. "In the last elections, you did not even present a candidate. Nobody fool enough to lose his deposit, and the Smuts party returned General Courtney unopposed." The eldest of his listeners nodded over his gold pince-nez, inviting him to continue. "If you are to fight the Ladyburg seat, you will need a candidate with a different approach, an English speaker, a man of property, somebody with whom the voters can identify." It was a beautiful performance. Dirk Courtney, handsome, debonair, articulate in either language, striding back and forth across the carpeted lounge, holding all their attention, stopping dramatically to make a point with a graceful gesture of strong brown hands, then striding on again. He talked for half an hour, and he was watching his audience, noting the reaction of each, judging their weaknesses, their strengths. At the end of that half hour, he had decided that all four of them were dedicated, completely committed to their political faith. They stirred only at appeals to patriotism, to national interest, at reference to the aspirations of their people. "So," Dirk Courtney thought comfortably, "it's cheaper to buy honest men. Rogues cost good bright gold, while honest men can be had with a few fine words and noble sentiments. Give me an honest man every time." One of the older men leaned forward and asked intently, "General Courtney has had the seat since 1910. He is a member of the Smuts cabinet, a war hero, a man of huge popular appeal. He is also your father. Do you think the voters will take the young dog when they can have the sire?" Dirk answered, "I am prepared not only to risk my deposit if I achieve the National Party nomination, but I am confident enough of my eventual success to make a substantial earnest of my serious intentions to the campaign funds of the party." He named a sum of money that made them exchange quick glances of surprise. "In exchange for all this?" the elder politician asked. "Nothing that is not in the best interest of the nation and of my constituency," Dirk told them soberly, and he pulled down the map that hung on the far wall facing them. Again he began to speak, but now with the contagious fervour of the zealot. In burning words he built up a vision of ploughed fields stretching to the horizon, and sweet clean water running deep in endless irrigation furrows. The listeners were all men who had farmed and ploughed the rich but hostile soil of Africa, and all of them had searched blue and cloudless skies with hopeless eyes for the rain clouds that never came. The image of deeply turned furrows and slaking water was irresistible. "Of course we will have to repeal the proclamation on the Bubezi Valley," Dirk said it glibly, and not one of them showed shock or concern at the statement. Already they could see the inland sea of sweet, limpid water ruffling in the breeze. "If we win at this election," the eldest politician began. "No, Meneer," Dirk interrupted gently. "When we win." The man smiled for the first time. "When we win," he agreed. Dirk Courtney stood high on the platform with thumbs hooked into his waistcoat. When he smiled and tilted that noble lion head with the shining mane of curls, the women in the audience that packed the church hall rustled like flowers in the breeze. "The butcher," said Dirk Courtney, and his voice rang with a depth and resonance that thrilled them all, man and woman, young and old. the butcher of Fordsburg, his hands red with blood of our countrymen. The applause began with the men that Dirk Courtney had in the audience, but it spread quickly. I rode with Sean Courtney against Bombarda. One man was on his feet, near the back of the hall. I went to France with him, he was shouting to be heard above the applause. And where were you, Mr. Dirk Courtney, when the drums were beating? The smile never left Dirk's face, but two little spots of hectic colour rose in his cheeks. Ah! He faced the man across the craning heads of the audience. One of the gallant general's gunmen. How many women did you shoot down at Fordsburg? That doesn't answer my question, the man shouted back. And Dirk caught the eye of one of the two big men, who had risen and were closing in quietly on the questioner. 4,000 casualties, said Dirk. The government would like to hide that fact from you, but 4,000 men, women and children. The two big men had closed in on their quarry, and Dirk Courtney drew all eyes with a broad theatrical gesture. A government that has that contempt for the life, property and freedom of its people. There was a brief scuffle, a yelp of pain, and the man was hustled out of the side door into the night. The newspapers started picking it up almost immediately. The same editorials which had ranted against the Red Cabal and the Bolshevik threat, which had praised Smuts's direct and timely action, were now remembering a high-handed and brutal solution. Across the nation, begun by Dirk Courtney and picked up by all the Herzogites, the balance of public feeling was swinging back, like a pendulum, or the curved blade of the executioner's axe. Dirk Courtney spoke in the town hall of Durban, to 3,000 in the church hall of Ladyburg, to 300. He spoke at every country church in the constituency, at little crossroad general dealer shops where a dozen voters assembled for an evening's entertainment. But always the press was represented. Dirk Courtney worked slowly northwards, during the day visiting all his land holdings, each of his new cane mills, and each evening he spoke to the little assemblies of voters. Always he was vibrant and compelling, handsome and articulate, and he painted a picture for them of a land crossed with railways and fine roads, of prosperous towns and busy markets. They listened avidly.
There are two, said Pungushi. One is an old lion. I know him well. He stayed last year in Portuguese territory along the north bank of the Usutu River. He was alone then, but now he has found a mate.
Where did they cross? Mark asked.
They crossed below Ngumu and came south between the swamp and the river.
The lion was 5 years old and very cunning, a lean tom, tall at the shoulder and with a short ruff of reddish mane. There was an ugly bald scar across his forehead, and he favoured his right foreleg, where a piece of hammered pot-leg fired from a Tower musket 2 years previously had lodged against the shoulder joint. He had been hunted by man almost without remission since he was a cub, and he was getting old now and tired. He crossed the river in the dark, swimming his lioness ahead of him, going south from the hunters who had assembled to drive the bush along the river the next morning. He could hear the drums still beating and smell the smoke of their fires. He could hear also the yapping clamour of the dog packs. They had assembled 200 or 300 tribesmen with their hunting dogs and a dozen Portuguese half-breeds with breech-loading rifles, for the lions had killed 2 trek oxen on the outskirts of one of the river villages. In the morning the hunt would begin, and the lion took his mate south. She was also a big animal, and though she was still very young and not as experienced, yet she was quick and strong, and she learned from him each day. Her hide was still clean and unscarred by claw or thorn. Across the back, she was a sleek olive tan, shading down to a lovely buttery yellow at the throat and fluffy cream on the belly. She still had traces of her kitten spots dappling her quarters, but the night they swam the Usutu, she came into season for the first time. On the south bank, they shook the water from their bodies with fierce shuddering spasms, and then the lion snuffed at her, drumming softly in his throat, and then lifting his snout to the bright white stars, his back arching reflexively at the tantalizing musk of her pale, blood-tinged oestrus discharge. She led him half a mile up one of the thickly wooded tributary valleys, and then she crept into the heart of the thicket of tangled bush, a stronghold guarded by the fierce 2-inch wickedly hooked thorns, tipped in red, as though they had already drawn blood. Here, in the dawn, he covered her for the first time. She crouched low against the earth, hissing and crackling with angry snarls, while he came over her, biting at her ears and neck, forcing her to submit. Afterwards she lay close against him, licking at his ears, nuzzling his throat and belly, turning half away from him, and nudging him flirtatiously with her hindquarters, until he rose and she crouched down submissively and snarled at him, while he mounted her briefly once again. They mated 23 times that day, and in the night they left the thorn thicket and wandered southwards again. A half hour before the set of the moon they reached the edge of the ploughed land, and the lion stopped and growled softly at the smell of man and cattle. Tentatively he reached out one paw and tested the freshly turned earth. Then he drew his leg back and made a little troubled mewing sound of indecision. The lioness brushed herself lovingly against him, but he turned aside and led her along the edge of the ploughed land. "Will they reach the valley, Pungushi?" Mark asked, leaning out of the saddle to speak to the Zulu as he trotted at Trojan's shoulder. Pungushi spoke easily, despite the fact that he had run without rest for nearly 3 hours. "They must cross almost half a day's march of land where men are working, where the ploughs of the new sugar growers are busy. Besides, Jamela, they know nothing of your valley and the mad Ngaga who would welcome them." Mark straightened in the saddle and rode on grimly. He knew that this pair, this mating pair, would be his last chance to have lions in his valley. Yet there was 20 miles of danger to cross, such as these animals, coming out of the wilderness of Portuguese Mozambique, would never have experienced before. Ploughlands, declared cattle area, where lions were vermin, an area devoid of wild prey, but heavily populated with domestic animals, an area where the cry of lion would send 50 men running eagerly for a rifle, 50 white men competing fiercely for the trophy, hating the big predatory cats with a blind, unthinking hatred, welcoming what was probably their only chance at one of them, safe in the knowledge that they were fair game, unprotected by law in the cattle areas. The lions came to the camp downwind, and they lay flat in the short grass in the darkness at the edge of the camp. They listened to the drowsy voices of the men at the fire, and smelled the myriad strange smells of tobacco smoke, of cooking maize meal, and the sour tang of Zulu beer. And they lay very flat and tense against the earth, only their round black-tipped ears cocked, and their nostrils flaring and sucking the air. The oxen were kraaled with a low circular enclosure of felled thorn trees, arranged with their trunks inward and the bushy thorny tangle outwards. The smell of the cattle was strong and tempting. There were 72 oxen in the kraal, 2 full spans. They belonged to the Ladyburg Sugar Company, and they were ploughing the new lands east of Sharker's Gate, after the labour teams had stumped out the standing timber and burned it in long windrows. The lion waited, patient, but alert and tensed and silent, while the silver moon went down below the trees and the men's voices dwindled into silence. He waited while the fires died down into puddles of dull ruddy ash. Then he rose silently. The lioness did not move, except that the great muscles in her chest and limbs swelled rigid with tension, and her ears cocked fractionally forward. The lion circled cautiously upwind of the camp. There was a soft, cool wash of breeze coming steadily out of the east, and he used it skilfully,